WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with playwright Alan Zweibel about his friendship with Gilda Radner. It's the subject of his new play called Bunny Bunny. The two met while working on Saturday Night Live. And actor Bruno Kirby will join us, too. He's starring in the play. Also, Paul Theroux on the real and fictional life of a travel writer. That's the subject of his new book, My Other Life. Linguist Jeff Numberg traces how the political language of the 60s has been transformed into the corporate speak of the 90s. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Earl Hines reissue of Cole Porter tunes. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. One of the most beloved comedians on Saturday Night Live was Gilda Radner. Her hilarious send-up of Barbara Walters, Baba Wawa, and her zany, lovable Emily Latella and Roseanne Rosanna Dana were high points of the show's early years.
So what does she do? She opens her perfect little purse and takes out a perfect little Kleenex and draws her perfect little fez and then throws a perfect little Kleenex into a perfect little Tiffany trash can. But what this cutie didn't know was when she wiped off her nose, she didn't push back in this one little perfect little nose hair. It just stuck out there, and it was long, and it was black, and it was perfect, and I thought I was gonna die. Just between you and me, Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana, I felt like yanking down two more hairs, braiding them, and putting a bead at the end.
Radner's collaborator on the set was writer Alan Zweibel, who, like her, was in his early 20s and just getting started in his career. The two of them hit it off right from the start, and their friendship remained strong until Radner's death from cancer. A couple of years ago, Zweibel wrote a book about their relationship called Bunny Bunny, which he has adapted into a play. It had its premiere last week in Philadelphia. Playing the part of Alan Zweibel is actor Bruno Kirby. Kirby has appeared in Spinal Tap, Tin Man, Godfather 2, The Freshman, and Barry Levinson's new film, Sleepers. Zweibel has received numerous awards for his television work. He created and produced It's Gary Shandling Show, among others. Zweibel told me about the origin of the title of his play.
Bunny Bunny was a, sort of a superstition that Gilda had. I since found out that other people have the same sort of superstition. She felt that if the first words out of her mouth on the first day of the month were Bunny Bunny, it would bring like good luck for that month and it would ward off bad things. And as I started to promote the book, I found out that some people say rabbit, rabbit.
Right, I've heard that.
I've heard rabbit, rabbit.
Because where I grew up, we said rabbi, rabbi. This is a Long Island thing. So I didn't know about this, but that's where I first heard it. And that's what, it's sort of thematic in the book and in the play. It comes up a couple of times.
How has writing this book, now turning it into a play, how has that helped you heal the pain that you felt from her death?
You know, I can't tell. I think it has. You know, I wrote this just at the behest of my wife, who said about 3 or 4 years after Gilda died, you know, you're going to have to deal with it sooner or later. You know, you're going to have to get some sort of closure. And so I said, all right, and I wrote it. And I was working on a movie at the time, so it was like a journal. In the morning, late at night, when everybody was sleeping. And I just wrote it in dialogue, because it was just for me. I just wanted to relive the relationship one more time. And I didn't want, like, paragraphs and punctuation to impose itself. And then at the end of 9 months or so, I figured, okay, we got closure. Okay, good. Well, then I ultimately published it. Okay, closure. Okay, now it's a play. I keep on closing and opening and closing. So I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Last night at the premiere, people were crying in the second act, and it was a really nice night, and I just walked into the lobby sort of spent, and I'm going, why do I do this to myself? You know, I'm thrilled that people like it, but on a personal level, I'm going, wow, I can't take this roller coaster. Yeah, it's really draining.
Well, is it draining for you, Bruno Kirby, to play the part of Alan in this play and also to relive some of the intimacy of that relationship?
No, I wouldn't describe it as an actor. I find it just the opposite. It's invigorating. In this play, there's so much that happens to the character of Alan Zweibel in terms of his relationship with her. I mean, you get to see these two people genuinely fall in love and try and work through that and accept it and try and define this relationship, what it's going to be, what it's not going to be. And you see how much she must really mean to him, because he does whatever he can to keep her in his life. To me, this is a love story at a very high level, because it's a love story about two people who never really have sex. That's very unusual for a man and a woman to keep a relationship alive when it's not sexual in any way. And it's a tremendous piece of work.
As you look back at your relationship with Gilda Radner, are you sorry you weren't sexual, intimate, or are you glad that you resisted?
I'm not the one who resisted.
Yeah. I think I was the one, in answer to your question. But you respected her.
Yeah, you
resisted.
Want to know? Yeah, kicking and screaming. Yeah, that was a form of respect. I was, you know, something. If where I was at that time in my life, if it had been anything more than just a friendship, I don't think we'd be here talking about this right now.
Well, that's what I mean.
So the answer is yeah. I mean, I'm real happily married. I got the three best kids on the planet, and I still have this other thing in my life that I look at this play and I go, how lucky was I? I was living this fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I would be able to say that had it been any other way. And she was the architect of that.
Well, Alan Zweibel, take us back to that time if you can. We can relive some of the early days of Saturday Night Live. Tell us, first of all, how you met Gilda Radner.
Oh, it was the first day ever. It was in Lorne Michaels' office. There was this big meeting. All the writers and the actors met in Lorne's office, and I was 24, and Lorne had found me. I was working at a delicatessen in Queens, New York, and You name it, I sliced it for about 2 years, okay? And I was writing jokes for all these stand-up comedians in the Borscht Belt for $7 a joke, then $10 a joke. And so to supplement this wonderful living, I was working in a deli. But
for people like Rodney Dangerfield.
Rodney Dangerfield and Freddie Prinze. Mm-hmm. But that was the high end already. I mean, I'd done tons of singers and every Mickey, Morty, Lee, and Dickie that ever lived and played the Catskill Mountains, I wrote for. And they were twice my age, and the sensibilities were different. So what I did was I took the jokes they wouldn't buy, and I made a stand-up comedy act for myself. And I went to the city every night to catch a rising star in the improvisation, got on stage, delivered my jokes with the hope that somebody would come in and like my writing and give me a job. Well, one night around 2 o'clock in the morning, I get off the stage and I'm sweating like a pig. I had the hardest time making these six drunks from Des Moines laugh. And I go to the bar and I'm waiting for my ride home. Billy Crystal was starting out at that time also. And he lived three towns away from my parents. And he was married and had children because he's more mature than me. And I was waiting for Billy to get off the stage so we can drive home. And I'm sitting at the bar and this guy comes in. He sits next to me and he looks at me. And after a minute or so, he says, you know, you're the worst comedian I've ever seen in my life. And I went, yeah, I know. It's really pathetic. He said, but the material's not bad. Did you write it? And I said, yeah. He said, would I be able to see more of it? I said, you bet. And I didn't even ask who it was because I would have shown it to like a gardener at that point. It was Lorne Michaels, okay? And he gave me a job on its brand new show.
Wow. And obviously, as a writer, not as just a writer. One of the performers.
No. But what happened was 2 months later, we started the show, and it was the first writers' meeting and cast meeting. Everybody got to know each other. And I walked into Lorne's office, and I look around, and I see Belushi, and I see Aykroyd, and Chevy, and I'm going, oh my God, I'm a fraud. They're going to discover me.
And you're 24 years old.
24, and there's no way in hell that I can compete with these people. So I looked around the room, and in a corner of the room, there was this big potted plant that I very maturely went behind and squatted down and hid so I wouldn't have to be called on and embarrass myself.
You mean that, really? Literally?
Literally squatted behind a plant because I didn't feel like I can sell my sketches, you know, because you had to perform them in a way, and there was a social aspect to it. So I'm squatting behind this plant, and about 10 minutes into the meeting, I hear this voice coming from the other side saying, can you help me be a parakeet? And I went, what? And I hear the voice say, this girl's voice say, yeah, I think it'd be really funny if I sort of squished up my face, stood on a perch and acted like a parakeet, but I need a writer to help me figure out what the parakeet would say. And she says, can you help me figure it out? I go, yeah. I didn't have any idea what she was talking about. And I parted the leaves and I looked through and it was Gilda. And we got to talking and it ended up that she was just as scared as I was. So she came around the plant and we squatted down there and we spent the rest of the meeting there and we started becoming friends.
Let me turn to you, Bruno Kirby, because you've been in some wonderful films. You're an actor who I've really enjoyed in just about everything that you have done. How did you get your start in acting?
Well, my dad is a wonderful actor. His name is Bruce Kirby. And we're incredibly close. I was born on his birthday. And his attitude when I came along was, well, here's my best friend. That was his attitude. He literally took me every place he went. He took me to Lee Strasberg's class. He sat me down next to people like Marilyn Monroe and told me to be very quiet.
How old were you at the time?
Oh, I was just a little kid. I don't even know how old I was. He took me immediately. And he would also do this thing, my dad, where he would work as a maitre d'. And he would come home at night, sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning. It didn't matter even if it was a school night. And his nickname for me was Pal. And he'd say, hey, Pal, are you awake? And I'd say, yeah. And he'd pick me up and he would take me to 42nd Street. And we would sit there when 42nd Street was much different than it is now. And we would watch Fellini films together at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we would just hang out together. And I love him to this day. He's my best friend. And I think I'm an actor because of him. When he would go out after class with his actor friends and sit around and do jokes and shtick for each other, and I would be part of it. That's still to this day my favorite part of acting is the camaraderie, the group effort. I really appreciate that a lot.
We'll hear more from writer Alan Zweibel and actor Bruno Kirby after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to writer Alan Zweibel and actor Bruno Kirby. Well, let me turn to you, Alan Zweibel. When did you begin writing jokes? I mean, were you one of the funny kids in class, the class clown, the kid that got taken to the principal's office for disrupting?
No, I was a big jock. And I was, you know, when the old Dick Van Dyke show came on television, I went, wow, that's sort of cool. You know, you just sit around with some other people, you just crack jokes all day, and you go home to Laura Petri, and you got this nice house in New Rochelle. What's wrong there? You know, that could be good. So I just try to figure out how to do that. And unfortunately, there was no prescription as to how you get to be that. I don't know two writers who got to wherever they are the same way. It was just, it's not like, you know, you want to be a doctor. Well, there's certain rules that you do and you persevere and it's real hard, a lot of studying, but there's a course you take and eventually you're a doctor. With this, I just didn't know what to do. So I went to school at the University of Buffalo up in New York, and I don't know if you know anything about Buffalo, but it gets cold there over the winter.
Heard lots of snow, right?
And what I would do is I started writing jokes that I sent into to Johnny Carson when he had a show in New York, and Dick Cavett and Mad Magazine, just to test the waters and just unsolicited stuff. And they started using some of my stuff. And I didn't care that I wasn't getting paid. It was just encouragement, because you don't know if you have anything to offer. You know, it's one thing to be sort of funny at a party, but, you know, can you manufacture a situation and then be funny within that? And when I left college, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I'd never wanted to really be a lawyer, but I figured I don't know how to do this writing thing. So I figured I'd go to law school, get a degree and put it in a drawer and then go out and, you know, but at least have like a net to work with. The law schools had something else in mind for me. I took the law boards, which is like the SATs. You know, if you can just write your name.
Right, you get 100 points or
something.
Well,
200. You get everything right, you get 800. Right. So 200 for writing your name. I got a 310, which was like vegetable mentality. It was pathetic. It was really – so basically they said, no. You be a writer. And so when I left college, I started hanging out at the clubs and writing jokes and writing for those guys up in the Catskills.
Well, you mentioned the Dick Van Dyke Show, and in your play you say, when I was a little boy, I used to watch the old Dick Van Dyke Show and say that that's the kind of life I want to have, you know, to be a TV comedy writer, have a wife, a family, a home. That was my goal. And then Gilda says back to you, and you're achieving it. Do you feel like you have?
Yeah, I'm real lucky. I mean, I got this great wife, and I got three kids, and, you know, the weird part is that I was doing a Steve Martin special a long time ago, and we were rehearsing in NOLA Studios in New York. I think it was like 57th and Broadway at the time. And we were like rehearsing in Studio A. And in Studio B, Dick Van Dyke was rehearsing for some special he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I heard he was there. And this is like 81-ish. And we had just had our first child, Adam. And I go, wow, I just want to thank the guy for his inspiration. So after rehearsal ended one day, I waited, and he came out, and I took an elevator down with him, and I said, well, Mr. Van Dyke, I just wanted to thank you for being such an inspiration to me. My name is Alan, and I grew up watching your show, and I said I wanted to be a comedy writer and marry someone like Laura. And I said, well, you know, I have this real pretty wife. I'm a comedy writer. We're thinking maybe buying a house, and we just had our first kid, just like you and, you know, Mary Tyler Moore had Richie, and you know, it's like working, and I just want to thank you for giving me this thing to shoot for. And he put his arm around me, and he said to Alan, just a word of caution, he said, after 5 years, the Van Dyke Show was canceled, and I became an alcoholic. And I went, ah, I see, okay. That was a rough elevator ride. So, I'm pretty lucky. Very, very lucky to achieve that.
It must be, though, interesting to write for different kinds of people, from Rodney Dangerfield to Gilda Radner to Johnny Carson to Gary Shandling, because everybody has their different body language, their different styles, different nuances. I mean, how much does a comedy writer have to take all of that into account?
That's a great question. What I used to do is, you're absolutely right, because what was funny for Jack Benny, it came out of character and wouldn't necessarily be funny for Johnny Carson or for Joan Rivers. What I used to do as a way of just training myself, and I made this up. No one taught me to do this. Mm-hmm. It just made sense to me. I'd sit down on a Monday morning and I'd say, okay, this week we're going to, the subject is iced coffee, okay? Monday, I would write a monologue as if Woody Allen was delivering it about iced coffee. Tuesday would be as if Phyllis Diller was doing it, and Wednesday, Jack Benny. And by the end of the week, I had five different monologues about iced coffee. Each had a different syntax, a different rhythm to it, and try to tune my ear to different people. And then what that does for you ultimately is it allows you to write a script where everybody doesn't sound the same. So the training that one gets when they're writing for different voices is invaluable. The hardest jokes to write, those are the easy jokes to write, because you write for Rodney Dangerfield and he's got this I don't get no respect thing. It's really easy for me to write. You know, even as an infant, I didn't get any respect. When I was born, my mother wouldn't breastfeed me. She said she liked me as a friend. Okay, that's an easy thing to do. That's easy because, you know, you just put that in his mouth. It's the jokes that have to stand by themselves, you know, no matter, and get a laugh no matter who. What voice delivers them, those are the hardest ones to do.
Tell us about working with Gary Shandling. And I have to say, I love the Larry Sanders Show. I thought that was about the best thing on television for some time. And he does have a gentle, self-deprecating kind of humor that's so inviting.
Gary, like I mentioned before, is just a man. He's just totally exposed. He's raw. And I respond to just that honesty there. He is, I was lucky because what I had, I thought with Gilda, I had with Gary. Gilda had brought like the woman out in me and I brought out the guy in her. Gary and I, we took turns, you know, because, you know, both guys and you'll be the woman today, I'll be the woman tomorrow, you know, but it was, it's rare when two people meet and, all of a sudden it's just like when you fall in love with somebody, how do you define it? There's just something that's there. Gary is, I think in my estimation, the smartest guy out there. I think he's an insanely great writer. I think that he's got a better sense of himself than anyone that I know. And if I wanted to be really lofty about it, I would think that he is one of the few guys out there now, in my estimation, I don't know everybody, so I'm just talking about the people that I know, okay?
Right.
That can get a laugh based on nuance because you know the character. Jack Benny, the longest recorded laugh in radio history was Jack Benny with silence. It was when a robber came up to him and put a gun in his back and said, your money or your life. And Jack Benny was just silence. And people knew that he was cheap. That was his trademark. And the longer he didn't talk, the louder and louder the audience laughed. And if you listen to the tapes, they laugh for about 40 seconds. And then the robber goes, well, and Jack Benny goes, I'm thinking, okay? And then they laugh. And
right.
Gary has created a character, a persona for himself where he doesn't have to do jokes. There are nuances and they're just subtleties that you know the character that well that it's funny to you. And
yeah.
He's great.
Can you write for someone you don't like?
Wow, what a great question. I tried that a couple of times. I've had a couple of series that didn't work, and I found myself that I couldn't do it. I can't even imagine trying to get into that head and that whole psyche where you would be that kind of person, and I think that's masterful. I know that on the few occasions where I made wrong choices and took wrong series or created something but cast it improperly, it's that thing where you're trying to take somebody who is what they are and make them into something that you want them to be. And when you see that that doesn't work, you go, all right, let me go the other way. Let me feed what they are and go, you know something? I don't know how to get into that, you know? And that might be a deficiency I have as a writer, you know? But at the same time, I find that very difficult because it doesn't come off honest.
Yeah, what do you think about that, what he just said?
Just to make it into an acting question, can you play somebody who you don't like?
Right.
Well, in certain cases, I played a pedophile in Basketball Diaries and this abusive guy in Sleepers, and those were the first times that I've played some people who, you know, in Sleepers, I could find some things about that guy because I knew how he had to be abused to end up that way, and the pedophile, there's something about someone who abuses children. That is really hard. That was the first time I ever played somebody that, even though I could understand them, I couldn't like them. So it makes it, you know, very difficult. So I imagine just writing for someone who you didn't like. Because, you know, I was around the show that they did together. I worked on it. I played Gary's manager on the Gary Shandling show. And I watched them work together, and it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, we'd be shooting that show, and they could go off in a corner with an audience
there.
And just stop things for 5 minutes and come up with a whole new point of view on a scene together. It was like a magical thing. And so I would imagine to take that energy and try and give it to someone who you didn't really care for as a person would be very difficult, I would imagine.
That's Bruno Kirby and Alan Zweibel. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, producers of the 4-CD box set In Their Own Voices, A Century of Recorded Poetry, an anthology of significant poets of our time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, My Other Life. Travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux considers what his life could have been like. He calls his new book an imaginary memoir. Linguist Jeff Numberg comments on how the language of the leftist 60s has influenced today's corporate speak. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of Cole Porter tunes by Earl Hines. We're listening to it now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Pianist Earl Hines had a longer recording career than almost any major figure in jazz. He made his first records in the mid-1920s and continued to record until not long before his death in 1983. He was once known for playing something called trumpet-style piano, but jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says his influences come from further afield. Here's Hines playing I Get a Kick Out of You from a 1974 set of Cole Porter tunes.
Hines was the crazy cat of jazz piano players. He had that cartoon character streak of joyful anarchism. Hines respected the chords and forms of the tunes he improvised on, but just barely. His own stream of ideas, ebbing and flowing in time, one hand working against as often as with the other, that had its own peculiar logic. But playing laid back or tasteful or not too many notes, Earl Hines was too much of a showman for that. Hines is often said to play trumpet-style piano, which is supposed to mean his right hand played single-note lines rather like a horn player's. As you can hear, that's not true. I think the term stuck because any early jazz musician with such flexible rhythm and forceful personality reminded folks of Louis Armstrong. But Earl Hines' technique was always heavily pianistic, steeped in the jazz and showbiz piano styles of the 20s. Jazz piano before Hines was about keeping a lot of notes going all the time in busy patterns for either hand. The bebop piano style that emerged after he was established was more linear and self-consciously saxophone-like. Hines was the key transitional figure. His left hand was the real capital of the revolution. One minute he'd play stride piano rhythms to match Fats Waller. A second later, his clear bass line would simply vanish or degenerate into seeming gibberish. With Hines, as with Waller, who also came up in the 1920s, his transitions were informed by the new language of motion picture editing. The way one movie scene can dissolve into the next, Hines might finish up an idea with one hand while beginning a new idea with the other. This overlap shares something with cubism, too. It's like looking at the same material from several angles at once, so you may be unsure what you're looking at. That's Easy to Love from the CD reissue Earl Hines Plays Cole Porter, recorded in 1974. Hines was one of the rare jazz innovators who did some of his best work at the end of his career, a series of solo piano albums begun in the 1960s. In some cases, like this one, he let the producer pick the tunes. Hines must not have liked Cole Porter songs very much. He never recorded any before or after this session. But for Hines, one tune is pretty much as good as another. All the materials he used, standard songs, the jazz vocabulary, the piano, all of it just seemed a medium for Earl Hines' self-expression. He was and is an original. In an age when almost any jazz style can be copied by somebody, nobody I know sounds like Earl Hines.
Kevin Whitehead is currently living in Amsterdam working on a book. This is Fresh Air. If you think you knew Paul Theroux from his many books on travel, like The Great Railway Bazaar, and his novels like Mosquito Coast, you might want to think again. In his new book, My Other Life, Theroux has created an interesting challenge for readers. The novel is about a writer named Paul Theroux, who, like the real writer, has lived in Africa, Singapore, England, and America. In writing My Other Life, Theroux says he was entirely driven by his alter ego's murmurs of, "What if?" He says it's the writer's privilege to keep some facades intact and to use his own face in the masquerade. I spoke to Paul Theroux in front of an audience at the Free Library of Philadelphia in October, and I asked him to tell me about the character, Paul Theroux.
Fiction gives us the second chance that life denies us. Life denies us all a chance of going back. If you want to do something, you want to fantasize about having married someone else or quit a job or meeting a psychopath or, I don't know, lying to your psychiatrist or falling in love or whatever it is, that the writer can vicariously live out that fantasy. And I think that I've been told that the character in this book is faintly unpleasant, or
I've heard worse than that.
Devious. Well, I think I was very averse to putting myself in a grand light, you know, to making myself look too good, because then it would look as though I was making myself better than I am. But I think probably I prefer to look worse than better.
Well, it's interesting in the book because Paul Theroux, the character, meets people who have read his book, but they don't know that he is Paul Theroux. And it got me wondering how you think about your readers, if you do at all.
I think about my readers a lot. I was just in Africa. I was on the Zambezi, on the upper Zambezi, in Zambia. It goes, if you look at a map of Africa, it's south central. It starts way in the left-hand side near Angola, and it goes out to the Indian Ocean. And there was a man who never helped. There were four of us in canoes going down, threading between the hippos. Because hippos are very territorial. You have to be very careful not to upset them. If you do, they lower themselves in the water, and they come up under your boat, and they might take a bite out of your boat. Crocodiles are not a problem. Snakes, not a serious problem. Mosquitoes, slight problem. People, no problem. The only problem are hippos, hippopotami. So if remember that. And particularly, they can stay down for 7 minutes. So the thing is to look at the river and make sure that you've been looking at it for 7 minutes, because if it's 5 minutes, there might still be one down there, and when you're going across, he'll come up. So anyway, there was a man that never helped us with our packing up. In the morning, we'd set off just at dawn or just before dawn to get to a certain point before the heat of the day. Then we'd stop for about 3 hours or 4 hours, then set off again in the afternoon. This man was never, and I went over to him one day and I was thinking, this guy is always sitting under this tree. I was thinking, writing notes, but not helping, just the unhelpful person. And it's terrible to make an enemy of anyone on a camping trip. So as I say, he was with his wife. He was an ophthalmologist, though that's not relevant in this context. I went to him one day and I thought, I'm going to go over and I say, why don't you help, you know? Do us a favor, do yourself a favor. This stuff's heavy, we've got to pack the boats, canoes, and go off. I went over, and he had a book in his hand. It was one of my books. It was Ozone, big fat book. He was, you know, a third of the way through. And I said, what are you doing? You're reading a book? I said, I wrote that book. He said, are you Paul Theroux? I said, yeah, that's me. He suddenly said, I thought, well, if you're not going to help us, that's okay. You can, you've chosen a fairly sensible thing. Okay, that was one. And there was another one. You know, I started life as a pre-medical student. I have a science degree, and I wanted to be a doctor. And when I joined the Peace Corps in 1963 and went to Africa, I really did want to be a doctor. Anyway, at another place called Lukulu on the Zambezi, this was the upper Zambezi, I went to a hospital in a leper colony, and I met a doctor. He was Dutch, and I said, I'd like to see your hospital. Well, the problem there is AIDS. He saw an HIV or AIDS patient every day, a new one, every day. There's a very, very high rate of infection. Unfortunately, that's Zambia. It's the same in Zimbabwe and Mozambique and Malawi, unfortunately. And I said, I wanted to be you. I wanted to be you. And he said, well, so what did you choose to do? I said, well, I became a writer because I thought I can't go to medical school and be a writer. I can only choose one thing. I'm not Chekhov. Chekhov managed to go to Eastern Siberia, Sakhalin, as a traveler and a writer and a doctor. He was a good doctor and a good writer. Your near neighbor, William Carlos Williams, was a great gynecologist, obstetrician. He wrote great poetry. But it's a lot of few people that they can do both things well. Anyway, he said, so you're a writer, what do you write? I said, I write travel books, novels, and whatnot. And he said, do I know your name? And I told him. He said, I'm reading one of your books. He said, I'd love to do what you're doing. And I said, well, too bad we can't swap lives. He was reading the Dutch edition of The Happy Isles of Oceania. It had been given to him by 3 years before by members of his medical academy. And it said, the inscription, it said, this book by an adventurer to another adventurer, Peter Klabers, you know, have a good time in Africa. And when a book is written in Dutch, it's really thick. It looks like a monumental tome. So there's two examples. You say, do I meet my readers? There's two in Africa, in the most unlikely places. And so I do meet them occasionally in odd circumstances.
Well, I wonder if there's any hesitancy, because two things that you've said, one in a magazine interview, I have never met a writer who was greater than his work. And in this novel, you write, most writers are balder and smaller than you expect. This idea that somehow, when they meet you, you will disappoint them.
I think it is disappointing to meet writers, yeah. And when you think of the writers, you know, Alexander Pope was about 4.5 feet tall. Picasso was only about 5 feet tall. Just little, you know, bundle of energy. I'm not saying that if you're small, there's something wrong. But most people think a man doing a monumental painting, Guernica, huge painting, he's going to be a big, robust, but just a very tiny, energetic person. So yeah, I think it's kind of disappointing to meet writers, and that there seems to be no connection between the physical writer and the work. Of course there is. We know there is. Big, tall people don't become writers. They don't need to become writers. They have a command of the world. They sort of own the world. They can. Everyone will, you know, do what they say. But a writer is someone who's fantasizing about giving orders. He's going. He's writing about being tall.
Little Napoleons.
Yeah, I mean, no. Writers have to have problems. They wouldn't become writers if they didn't. Normal people don't become writers. Dysfunctional, lonely, reclusive. People who are bad at sports. People who don't fit in. It sounds funny, but I think it's true. Why would anyone who is normal and well-balanced ever become a writer or become creative? It's the people who are filling some void. Who become writers. I come from a very large family, and that can make a person a writer. Seven children. I'm just one of seven children. I think that's a factor. I do.
Did you have to leave this country, though, and go to Africa to be a writer? Join the Peace Corps, which you did?
I didn't have to, but it helped. I wanted to feel that I was doing something constructive. But anyone who goes to another country is a student, not a teacher. You're a child. You don't speak the language. It takes a lot of humility to go to another country, because you're at sea. You can't. That's why people stay in expensive hotels, I think, because it's so intimidating not to. In a good hotel, they say, "Well, everything's going to be all right. We'll look after you." But if you're away from the hotel, you're in the bush. You have to learn the language and find out how it works. That did make me a writer. It made me self-sufficient. But the most important thing, I suppose, that made me a writer was that I was away from my family. No one was asking me, what are you going to be? What are you going to be? What are you going to do? I would have said, I'm going to be a writer. What are you going to write? And I'd say, I don't know. About you, I guess. I'd say, what? I'm going to write something. And then they'd say, well, who's going to pay you? How are you going to get money? What are you going to do? They would ask me questions. Well, you should never be around people who ask you questions to which you have no answers. I mean, I think that might be a good lesson in life. If anyone's going to ask you a question that you don't have the answers to, stay away from that person. And if you're young, it's really helpful to not to have to answer those questions. No one asked me any questions.
Had anyone in your family ever been a writer? Was this just a totally alien occupation as far as your family was concerned?
No, I came from an educated family that understood, you know, literate, educated family, and my grandfather wrote poetry and was kind of self-publishing. No one had published a book. That was a mystery, but it was a mystery to most people. I mean, I think it's only recently that there's been a proliferation of writers. I didn't know where you begin. I thought write a book and somehow it would get published. I didn't know the modus operandi. It was a bit of a mystery, but I think it's a mystery to most people, even to highly educated people, even to, you know, people in universities ask me, how did you get your book published? Oh, and they, sometimes they say, how can I get my book published? And I think, well, you're a fairly intelligent person. Work it out. Figure it out. But the most important thing was that I was self-sufficient. I was on my own. I had elbow room. And I was in a culture that hadn't been studied much. So I had to I had to be small, grateful, humble, and learn about it. And it was wonderful. I learned another language. I remember asking an old man, this was in Africa, I learned Chinyanja, and I said, we were talking about what would now be called options, what are you going to do? And I said, he said, what are you going to do? Something like that. And he was an old man. He addressed me as Father Bambo. They didn't use the word Bwana. Bwana was a big master. But as between two people, all this man was probably in his late 60s, born about the turn of the century, then wise man, he was addressed me as Bambo, Father. And I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, Ukaipa nkope ziwa nyimbo. If your face is ugly, learn to sing.
And here you are.
Yeah. It was, you know, lateral thinking. You'll figure it out. So, yeah. Actually, on this last trip, I wrote down some more proverbs. Bore you with them, but there was a great one that someone told me, and they told me laughing. They said we were talking about just wisdom, just you know. I was talking about my mother, and this man said, "Makundi mako usumoana kuchepa mwendo." Your mother's your mother, even if she has a small leg, even if one of her legs is too small. Like the Irish say, "My mother, drunk or sober, she's right." Another one was, Matako ala bili tabuli kuchumbana. Two buttocks cannot avoid friction. So I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, there was a lot of earthy wisdom. And when I understood that, I thought, I can write about this.
Well, one of the things that I think you really are known for, and I certainly appreciate, is your ability to write dialogue and to be able to express someone through that kind of dialogue. And having lived all over the world, I don't know how many languages you speak or parts of languages that you speak, but are you an eavesdropper? Are you tuned into people's cadences, how they speak, as a kind of fingerprint for who they are?
Yes, I think I try to be an eavesdropper, but also it requires your close attention. I was in I was in Minneapolis the other day, and funny that you should say that, but I saw a man with a little badge that said Uptown Brown. And I said, that's an amazing... I said, do you mind if I ask you how you got that name? And he said, well, they used to call me Downtown Brown. When I played for the Peoria Falcons. And I used to shoot from downtown. But the older I got, the better I used to be. Now I'm Uptown Brown.
Oh, that's great.
So it's also writing things down. It's a nice little... I'll never use it. I thought... I'm going to sell that name to, what's his name? Elmore Leonard. Elmore Leonard's the sort of person, you could imagine him calling a book Uptown Brown.
Yeah. Writer Paul Theroux, his new book, a novel, is called My Other Life. We spoke at the Free Library of Philadelphia in October. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
The modern corporate culture of the 90s seems to have adopted some of the language of the social movements of the past. Our linguist Jeff Numberg wonders what this means for the corporations and the people who work for them.
When people complained about the state of the language 15 years ago, they invariably cited examples of bureaucratic double talk. Now they're much more likely to pick on the language of corporations. I suppose this is chiefly a sign of the growing anti-business sentiment in America that progressive critics like E.J. Dionne have been talking about. Polls have been showing the public more dissatisfied with corporations than with the government. And this has to be the first time ever that the Times bestseller list contains two books making fun of business, Scott Adams' The Dilbert Principle and Michael Moore's Downsize This. But we don't want to lose sight of one other reason for all the ridicule that people have been heaping on corporate language, which is that the language itself has become a lot more ridiculous. It takes nothing away from Scott Adams' talent to say that corporations have been making it awfully easy for him over the past 15 years or so. Downsizing and streamlining, total quality and vision statements, corporations didn't used to talk like that. And the odd thing is that a lot of this new style of talking originated with the 60s left. Take empowerment. The political use of the word started out in the civil rights movement in the late 60s when it still evoked the revolutionary slogans of the period, power to the people and the rest. Feminists picked it up soon after. From there, it moved rightwards along two different tracks. Conservatives like Jack Kemp and William Bennett took it up as a slogan for a policy of returning federal powers to the states and the private sector, and Clinton and the New Democrats started using it shortly afterwards. And in a parallel move, it was picked up by the Human Potential movement, who stripped it of its political content and handed it off to consultants and corporations as a way to get employees to feel good about a sudden increase in job responsibilities. Of course, any employee who was foolish enough to think that empowerment had the same meaning in a restructuring announcement that it did in a speech by Jesse Jackson was quickly disabused. Even so, the wonder is that the word made this trip at all. Can you imagine an old-style manager like Alfred Sloan or Thomas Watson adopting a word that had first been introduced by Norman Thomas or A. Philip Randolph? For that matter, can you imagine them hanging out with the likes of the Human Potential folks? Or take the trivialization of the word culture, which is even more ubiquitous in corporate press releases than empowerment is. As Mutual of Omaha put it, the difference between success and failure can be attributed to a set of shared values and behaviors that can combine to create a high-performance culture where all employees are excited about their work and tend to give more of themselves. There's nothing particularly new or interesting in this, except that 30 years ago, the company would have said simply that successful companies have to have a lot of team spirit. You want to know, what does culture add to the mix? Again, though, it all started with the social movements of the 60s. That's when the word culture first became balkanized and parochialized as a way of validating the experience of groups on the margins of society. There was the counterculture, the drug culture, the culture of poverty, gay culture, and from there it was only a short step to using the word to describe the mores of any group that had its own particular style and usages, hackers, surfers, lowriders, and all the rest. And once having a culture became a qualification for recognition as a social group, it was natural for corporations to want in. Of course, if corporations really were anything like distinct cultures, they wouldn't all be rushing to adopt exactly the same vogues and buzzwords. Nor, for that matter, would their employees all be posting the same Dilbert strips on the walls of their cubicles. The irony is that all this disaffection is feeding on the very words that are supposed to assuage it. They call for a more emotional commitment to the corporation at the same time the traditional economic contracts being torn up. It's a risky strategy for corporations to take. For all that the words have shifted to the right, empowerment and culture still have some resonance of the movements that gave birth to them. And you never know but what they'll want to start calling home.
Jeff Numberg is a linguist at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And here's a song from one of America's most tight-fisted corporate leaders.
Smithers, Turn on the surveillance monitors.
Yes, sir.
It's worse than I thought. Each morning at 9, they trickle through the gate. They go home early. They come in late. Reeking of cheap liquor, they stumble through the day. Never never give a thought to honest work for honest pay. I know it shouldn't vex me, I shouldn't take it hard. I should ignore their capering with a kingly disregard. But look at all those idiots, oh, look at all those boobs. An office full of morons, a factory full of fools. Is it any wonder that I'm singing the blues?
Yours is a heavy burden, sir.
I'm just getting started. They make personal phone calls on company time. They Xerox their buttockses and guess who pays the dime? Their blatant thievery wounds me, their ingratitude astounds. I long to lure them to my home and then release the hounds. I shouldn't grow unsettled.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.